Thanks for joining us. I'm Laura Kanoy of New Hampshire Public Radio, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Alabama schools are reporting high rates of absences for Hispanic students over the last few days. This since the state's new immigration law went into effect. Meanwhile, the Obama administration is coming down on these statutes. It's suing Alabama and Arizona for their laws and is reviewing four other states with similar statutes. Joining us to discuss this in the studio, Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Also with us, Angela Kelly of the Center for American Progress. Angela, thanks for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
And Steve Camerata, the Center for Immigration Studies. And Steve, welcome to you.
Good to be with you.
Also joining us from WWNO in New Orleans, Campbell Robertson. He covers the southern region for the New York Times. And Campbell, thanks for being with us as well. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, and Campbell, let's start with you. You've been on the ground. You've been reporting from Alabama. We're hearing about this exodus of Latinos from the state. What did you see?
Well, it's almost by definition hard to figure out how big this is. But when I was in Albertville in the northern part of the state, which is an area that has a lot of Latino immigrants because of poultry plants and there's some farms in that area, almost every person I talked to said they knew 40 families who had decided to just leave, possibly temporarily, some permanently. And a lot of people who had stayed behind were saying they'll give it a week, 2 weeks, see what happens with the law, see if things change, not only the appeal, but see exactly how it looks on the ground. So there are a lot of people who have either left or are considering it. There is some measurement if you look at schools. I think there were about 2,000 Hispanic students who were absent from school on Friday, which is about 900 more than 2 days before when the ruling came down that upheld a lot of the Alabama's law. And now, again, we don't know how many were just absent and how many had fled, but that's about 5% of the state's overall Hispanic population in schools. But I think we'll see even more over the coming weeks what this really means.
Well, and Campbell, what does the average Joe or Jane on the street in Alabama think about this law?
I think it depends on what the average Joe or Jane does for a living. You know, I talked to a lot of people who were in line, who were hopeful to get jobs at some of these poultry plants, and they're fans of the law. They think it'll open up jobs for them, and I think average Joe or Jane just out there probably is pretty supportive. But farmers, some small businessmen who have new regulations, police departments, some teachers who have to deal with this, poultry plant operators, there's a lot of anger by business owners that this is going to really hurt their business and the economy as a whole.
Well, Steve Camerata, I want to bring you into this. What do you make of this exodus from Alabama? We hear stories of people just selling their homes for $1,000 and leaving, large numbers of Latino students absent from school. What do you make of this, Steve?
Well, when Arizona passed its law in 2007, the research shows pretty clearly that the illegal immigrant population, some fraction of it did leave. It stopped growing. Nationally, from 2008, when the law really went into effect, to 2010, the illegal population in Arizona declined by about 16 to 18%, and nationally it only declined over that time period by about 7%. Now, subsequent research by the Public Policy Institute of California and also the Institute for the Study of Labor has shown that it was basically the illegals who left. They found no decline, say, in native-born Hispanics, no decline in naturalized citizens, and to the best of their ability, they didn't seem to find a decline so much in even in legal immigrants who are not citizens yet. So the law had the intended effect, which was to encourage illegal immigrants to leave the state and hopefully return to their home countries.
What do you make of what's going on in Alabama, Angela?
Well, I think it's naive to think that people will go back to their home country. I think it's much more realistic that if people are leaving, that they're probably going to a neighboring state or neighboring county. For example, in Prince William County, when they were passing very restrictive measures, there was an uptick in Latinos moving to Arlington and Fairfax. So people will probably make very serious adjustments in their lives because they're terrified. I think the question, though, is, does this resolve our broken immigration system? Are we dealing sensibly with the 11 million people who are here without status? Do we want to have a patchwork of states that basically are terrifying their populations and causing children to flee from schools? I don't think that's a sensible public policy solution. It's not a solution. And so we look at Alabama, frankly, with great dismay, because I think it's going to hurt the state economically. It's a fragile state, its economy, like all states. It's going to paint a not welcome sign on the back of the state, again, not helpful for the state. And it will simply result in the problem being moved deeper underground or to other places. So a more sensible approach is, frankly, one that lies in the hands of federal lawmakers.
Well, and we'll definitely pick up on those points. But to you, picking up on Angela's point, a patchwork of state law, she said, Jonathan Turley, you're our law professor. Why are states taking the initiative on this? Isn't immigration law the province of the federal government?
Well, that, of course, is going to be the question in these court actions. This is the third lawsuit against the Alabama case. This one, obviously, is very interesting, the last one being the federal government intervening. The federal government actually doesn't have to intervene. It was a unusual step, the degree to which the Obama administration is being a named party challenging a state law as opposed to being an amicus. But the issue goes to the Supremacy Clause in Article 6. That is, the Constitution says there is this order, this hierarchy of laws. And states are sometimes preempted. And your inclination is from the question is that the immigration tends to be something the federal government does, and that's certainly the case. However, the Supreme Court has said most clearly in a case called Altria in 2008 that where there's doubt, the presumption has to be in favor of the state. The presumption is against preemption because we have a system based on federalism where the states are allowed to have sort of 50 gardens grow to try their own experimentation with problems. So you have this very awkward and somewhat novel question with these laws as to where does state law begin and end in relationship to the federal government. The federal government's position is not that this is expressly preempted. To the contrary, Congress has indicated that state laws are allowed to be passed in this area. But they're arguing that there's implied preemption because the federal government occupies so much of this field, there simply is not room for state laws like this.
That's tricky. So is, in your opinion, Alabama on reasonable legal ground here or not?
Well, Alabama is sort of like Arizona on steroids. I mean, it is Arizona is very carefully crafted to basically amplify the federal laws, that is to essentially carry out the federal mandate. Alabama goes further. You know, the sponsor, Mickey Hammond, said that it was designed to, quote, attack every area of an illegal alien's life, close quote. So the purpose here is much, much more extensive. I think it's a close question. I really do. I think there's very good arguments on both sides. I don't believe that all of the parts of Alabama can survive. In fact, they did not survive Judge Blackburn's decision, but she did uphold significant portions. But I have to say also Blackburn's decision itself, in my view, has some flaws in it. You know, she says some things about the law that I find strange, where she says, for example, the law doesn't require schools or state officials to determine the legality of parents. But when I read the law, it seems to say precisely that. So there's going to be a lot of mix-up here, and I'm not too sure what's going to make it through.
All right, and if you want to join us on the Diane Rehm Show, call 1-800-433-8850, 1-800-433-8850, or send us your email at drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. And Campbell Robertson, back to you again. So just give us the bare bones, if you could, please, on Alabama's immigration law. What are sort of the main points of this law?
Well, I think Professor Turley was correct when he sort of summed up what Representative Hammond had intended, which was not only to go after employers, but to just make life extremely difficult for illegal immigrants in the state. For example, the law allowed, in fact, required police officers, if there's a reasonable suspicion, to try to ascertain the legality of people they've stopped in routine traffic stops or arrests. Now, these aren't people who can just be stopped at will. But there's most contracts between a legal immigrant and anybody are unenforceable. Business transactions with a state, like a license plate or a business license, are banned under the law. And there were some other aspects that were not upheld, such as harboring an alien, which was sort of broadly defined, and I think the judge found that they wouldn't stand, but that those would be outlawed as well. So it really tries to make every aspect of life extremely difficult for an illegal immigrant. So not only are they, at the employer level, they have to be verified and all that, but just merely existing within the state is made very uncomfortable.
Well, and Steve Camerata, Jonathan Turley, said that Alabama is Arizona on steroids, meaning their immigration statutes. What do you think?
Well, right. I mean, it looks like one of the things that distinguishes Arizona's illegal immigrant population is that it's grown very fast, very recently. The other thing is it's one of the few states where a majority of the foreign-born, perhaps two-thirds, small state estimates are always difficult, but it looks like there may be 130,000 illegal immigrants in the state out of a foreign-born of maybe 170,000. So it does appear that, and Arizona was actually another state like this, where the illegal immigrant population was, where the foreign-born was majority illegal, which is somewhat unusual because nationally it's about 28%. Other things that are interesting about Alabama is that it has a very high rate of unemployment and non-work among its less educated native-born population. There are almost 600,000 people who are native-born in Arizona of working age, 18 to 65, who are not working right now and don't have much education. That is, they don't have any education beyond high school. Their unemployment rate is, by some measures, 22%. So what clearly Alabama is trying to do is discourage new illegal settlement and encourage illegal immigrants to go home or at least leave the state, and trying to free up some of those jobs at the bottom end of the labor market.
All right. Well, coming up, more on states and immigration policy, and we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-433-8850. So stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're looking at the states taking the lead on immigration policy today on the Diane Rehm Show. You can join us with your questions and comments at 1-800-433-8850. Send us email at drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. And I'd like to go to the phones now, but Angela Kelly, I know you want to jump back in again, Vice President for Immigration Policy at the Center for American Progress. Go ahead, Angela.
Sure. I just want to make a point. The idea behind the law is to make life as miserable as possible for undocumented people and hope that they all leave. What the law will actually do, though, is affect every person in the state of Alabama, because you can't tell looking at somebody whether they're undocumented or not. And it's not as if all undocumented people just live in an apartment building all by themselves. The reality of it is that the undocumented population, 61% of them have been here 10 years or longer. 45% of them live in families with a partner and with a child. We have 4 million to 5 million U.S.-born kids that have one undocumented parent or perhaps two. Life is messy. It's not clean and easy. It's not as if you can just sweep up the undocumented people and have them leave the state. So that's one. And two, the economic impact on Alabama will be profound. If you look at Arizona, they've lost over $200 million in conferences that were canceled or were never booked. These are dollars that Arizona has left on the table in the wake of its law. Georgia, similar state to Alabama in terms of the economy, $300 million to $1 billion because of crops that have been left in the fields. So let's not kid ourselves that we can somehow make a little easy fix to our immigration laws in a state like Alabama and that it won't have severe reverberations.
Well, and here's a message that we got from Facebook from Usha, who talks about what you just said, Angela, that it's complicated. There are families involved. She says, even though I have empathy for the kids caught up in this issue, I still think it's unfair for some immigrants to get the benefits that I worked so hard to get legally. I am an immigrant who has gone through every legal step, right from entering this country to becoming a citizen, while paying around 40% of the taxes on the way. So you can have sympathy, but on the other hand, the law is the law.
Of course. And that is the problem, right? It goes back to my first comment that we don't have a functional, coherent immigration system. She's absolutely right to be upset. A person who's followed the rules doesn't want to see somebody else appear to be gimmicking the rules. But we have 11 million people here without status. Most of them have been here, as I said, more than a decade because we've been clamping down at the border. People are essentially locked in here. They're not going back to their home country. The economies are even weaker there. What we need to do is get them on the right side of the law, find a way to register them, make sure they pay taxes, that they learn English, that they go through background checks. I think that's a system that we could live with where all of us would benefit.
Let's take some calls again. 1-800-433-8850. And first up is Gina in Daytona Beach, Florida. Hi, Gina. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I agree with what Alabama is doing. Here in Florida, Governor Rick Scott has made huge cutbacks for education, so we don't have enough resources to take care of the needs of our own children, never mind illegal children, which brings up one more issue. We're lacking jobs here, very bad. Yet Scott recently said he would not punish Florida companies that hire illegals. This is Scott's gift for cheap labor to Florida employers and a slap in the face to our unemployed Floridians.
Well, and what do you think about this comment, Steve Camerati? You've probably heard this before.
Right. In general, the survey research shows most Americans think this kind of stuff is just common sense. Require employers to verify that new hires are here in the country illegally. If the police pull someone over, they have no documentation. They can produce no documentation. They have no driving record. And there's other things that make the police think that the person's here illegally. He can make that inquiry. It makes perfect sense. You always establish identity in this course of a traffic stop anyway, and part of that process can be determining legal status. The bottom line is the reason to do it, however, is those very high unemployment figures. We're spending over $30 billion a year educating children from illegal immigrant households. If we can encourage more illegal immigrants to return home, we can save that money at a time when our education system and our healthcare system is being overwhelmed. What Angie wants is basically to take individuals and let them stay. And if they stay, so do the cost. That is our fundamental dilemma. All the research shows that legalizing illegal immigrants will dramatically increase costs because they become eligible for a host of social programs, but it doesn't change the underlying reason for the cost. And the reason for the cost is the educational attainment of illegals. We think 80% have no education beyond high school, and a majority haven't even graduated high school. Unskilled immigrants are a large net fiscal drain on taxpayers, and they compete for jobs at the bottom end of the labor market where unemployment is already the highest. So that's why Alabama is doing what it's doing. Angie identifies very strongly with the illegal immigrants and in their plight. And to some extent, it seems to me that's to her credit. But the people who are harmed by illegal immigration, who are harmed by letting illegals stay, and if they got legal status, they don't enter into her calculation. And in terms of the Alabama legislature, that's who they're concerned about. The kids who have to go to crowded schools, the people who compete every day for jobs, the healthcare system that's overwhelmed. And that's why they're trying to encourage illegal immigrants to go home.
You know, Angela mentioned, and Campbell Robertson from the New York Times also mentioned, the economic impact. I saw an article this morning in the New York Times, I think it was, Steve, that talked about a farmer in Oklahoma who, which we're not talking about their laws today, but he decided, okay, I'm not going to hire any more illegal immigrants. I'm only going to hire local Americans. And he can't get the people he needs to harvest his onions. You know, a couple of local people came in and they worked for a day or two and they said, this is too hard. We don't want to do it.
Couple quick points. First off, we have an unlimited guest worker program called the H-2A program that allows people to come in unlimited, but they have protections, and employers generally don't like to have those protections. The second point point is jobs at the bottom end of the labor market pay dramatically less. Consider those meat and poultry processing plants in Alabama. Research shows that if you compare the wage in 1980 to the current wage, it pays 45% less in real. That is inflation-adjusted terms. So when those same employers come back and say, look, we can't find anybody, they're paying dramatically less. To get Americans to do the job, you probably are going to have to treat them better. You are going to have to pay them more. But I would argue, and I think most Americans agree, that if the poor in our country can make some more money, if their bargaining power is improved by the departure of illegal immigrants, that is a good outcome.
Well, thanks for that call, Gina. And again, the number 1-800-433-8850. Here's another comment from Facebook. This is from Jewel, who says, this puts the burden of enforcement on the school systems and leaves them vulnerable to litigation. She says that's not where the immigration issue should be handled. The school systems already have their plates full trying to educate kids. Many schools have limited budgets and can barely afford to buy books and pay teachers. Campbell Robertson from the New York Times, I want to bring you back into this as well. What are the schools in Alabama saying about this law? Let's hone in on that a little bit more.
Well, for right now, a lot of people in Alabama, schools and police departments are just trying to figure out exactly what all this means. Now, the law does not really change anything for people who are already enrolled, which is something that superintendents have been emphasizing, that if a child is enrolled now, there's no difference. Still, people are leaving. I mean, a lot of this is driven by rumor and fear, but it's the registration issue at the very front end that's going to make a difference. And, you know, I think that's schools say, look, it's the law, we'll abide by it. And it actually doesn't, as someone pointed out, I don't think it changes an enormous amount because you have a birth certificate. You generally show a birth certificate anyway. What's interesting, I talked to the superintendent in Albertville, which is the town where I was, which has a significant Latino population in the school, and he said every year, even though there's a significant Latino population, he said that every year there are about maybe 5 students who come in who don't have a birth certificate. So it's hard to say, but I think for now the schools are just kind of in a wait-and-see mode like everybody else.
Well, and Jonathan, the education issue relates to a Supreme Court ruling, an earlier court ruling that you mentioned earlier this hour. Just remind us what the Supreme Court has said about schools and illegal immigrants and how this Alabama law fits into that.
Well, the Alabama law directly bars or restricts illegal immigrants in being in post-secondary education or in the K through 12. What's interesting is in looking at the DOJ brief, I don't actually see a challenge to the public universities portion of the law. They focus on K through 12. The other parties in these actions actually do challenge both provisions, but notably the federal government focuses on K through 12. And under Section 8, only U.S. citizens of this law can enroll in public secondary education, and then Section 28 is the one that deals with K through 12. The Supreme Court has been fairly hostile to these types of state registration rules. In the Pyler case in 1982, the court struck down a law that denied funding to illegal aliens for education. Then Hines, the case in 1941. The court struck down a Pennsylvania law that required registration of every alien under 18. And the Hines case is particularly interesting because that case didn't have a clear conflict with the federal law. That was based on the state's argument there, it's similar to some of the state's arguments here. But at the same time, the Supreme Court is really all over the field. Just recently, the court ruled in Whiting and had a very strong statement from Chief Justice Roberts saying there was no preemption in that case of a immigration law dealing with businesses. So you have what is, quite frankly, a very conflicted line of cases, giving both of these sides a good position to go forward. I would find it somewhat surprising for the Supreme Court to go as far as the Department of Justice is asking, to say we just occupy this field, because there are previous decisions from the court that have recognized state laws. At the same time, I would be surprised if much of this Alabama law could get through that screen. Some of these things look a lot like prior cases. So what you may end up with this is a very important decision of the Supreme Court that readjusts this area, brings perhaps, I hope, a bit of clarity. But the most likely bet is probably that the federal government states may have to share this area, with the federal government being by far the bigger dog on the street. And I don't think the Supreme Court's going to allow any significant conflicts with federal jurisdiction. Now, there is an interesting aspect to this. That is, it was surprising to see the Obama administration intervene as a party as opposed to an amicus. They sort of doubled down on the immigration issue and said, we want to be out front on this one. But in court, they're making arguments that could come back to haunt them, because one of the reasons they're alleging there's a conflict is that the federal government reserves the right not to deport illegal aliens, not to enforce some of these provisions. How that plays back, I'm not too sure, but it creates this very novel situation where the federal government is saying part of our occupation of the field includes decision not to enforce these laws, even if the states feel that they should be enforced more vigorously.
Well, there's a lot of politics involved, and we'll get to that in just a minute. And the Homeland Security Secretary is giving a speech at this moment at American University talking about immigration policy. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Our number is 1-800-433-8850. Our email is drshow@wamu.org. And Angela, did you want to jump in there?
Yeah, I did. There are a couple points I wanted to go back to that Steve mentioned. Kids do cost money, absolutely. I'm the mother of two. I can tell you they're wickedly expensive. But undocumented people, like everyone else, pay taxes. And the Institute for Taxation and Economic Policy looked at Alabama undocumented folks and found that in 2010 that they paid $130 million in taxes, property taxes, sales taxes. A lot of people work with false Social Security numbers and they pay income tax. So there are numbers on both sides of the ledger. And we also know from a 1986 program where undocumented people were legalized that their wages went up and that they paid more in taxes, that their employers made more of an investment in them. And it's only then, when people have legal status, do you even the playing field for the U.S. worker. As long as we have an unauthorized population that can be pushed off the books and that won't complain, unscrupulous employers will pay them less. And who's left hurt by that are U.S. workers. So in the interest of U.S. workers and undocumented people, who I don't think are need to be at odds with each other, what has to happen is we need to make sure that employers follow the rules and that unauthorized immigrants get a chance to be in the system and to pay taxes. Only then will we have a sensible immigration policy where we're not asking preschoolers for papers.
Steve, go ahead and then back to our callers.
Very briefly, the reason illegal immigration generally reduces wages is not their illegal status, but because we're dramatically increasing the supply of workers. It's basic economics. If you add 1 million construction workers to the United States, you lower wages regardless of legal status. If you want wages for the less educated and the poor to do better, you have to encourage illegal immigrants to go home.
Let's take another one. This is Adolfo waiting in Hobart, Indiana. Hi, Adolfo. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been ever since this weekend, I've been thinking about this law, and one of the portions say that it is now illegal to, or it is a crime to harbor illegal immigrants. And it got me to think, what is going to happen to the illegal immigrants are already in the correction system, state and local, that are being sheltered by the state or the local agencies, and taxpayers are actually paying for them. Aren't they breaking their own rule?
What do you think about that? Can you answer that, Jonathan?
Well, first of all, the harboring provision, as Judge Blackburn indicates, is not likely to survive. But this does get into this murky area of what agencies, what businesses have knowledge of illegal status. It also creates new crimes. I mean, what's fascinating about Alabama is that they create in Section 10 a new crime of the willful failure to complete or carry an alien registration document. So in addition to harboring, there's all these very specific provisions that create new crimes. That's what makes Alabama's law so interesting. And I think that the sponsors probably understood that not all of these things can make it through that constitutional screen.
Well, here's another question from an emailer. And by the way, Adolfo, thanks for that call. This email is from Daniel. He says, how much of this is purely political? First Arizona, then several other states passing new immigration laws. He says, Republicans now want AG Holder investigated, other investigations. Daniel says, seems to be the strategy to tie the Obama administration up with legal challenges aimed at preventing it from functioning. I'd like to hear from you, Campbell Robertson, on this. What are the politics surrounding both Alabama's move and these other moves done by other states?
Well, I think part of that is right, and that there is a lot of politics here. I don't know if this was has anything to do with the Obama administration. Mickey Hammond, who is one of the creators of the bill, and Scott Beeson, who's the sponsor in the Senate, have been pushing bills like this for some time. It was only after 2010, when the Republicans took over a supermajority of the state legislature in Alabama, that it really gained some traction. So this has been something that its backers have been pushing for quite a while. But on the other hand, I don't think there's any question that it's a popular issue in Alabama, and that Senator Beeson, if I recall this correctly, specifically mentioned places like Albertville, where it's not only an issue of labor and an issue of taxpayer disputes, but it's sort of a cultural issue. I mean, in the downtown part of Albertville, a lot of the stores are catered to Latino customers, and that has created some tensions in the town. I mean, both Latino and white residents of the town will tell you that. And there's politics involved with that as well.
All right. Well, coming up, your calls and questions on the states shaping immigration policy, so stay tuned.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, dedicated to educating wonks to use knowledge to change the world. More at american.edu/wonk. By the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives, at gatesfoundation.org. And by Vicky and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. This is NPR.
Errol Morris's documentaries challenge conventional ways of interpreting the known world. The Academy Award-winning filmmaker on why what we see is often determined by our own beliefs. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Today, we're looking at immigration policy and moves by states like Alabama to limit illegal immigration. We welcome your comments and questions at 1-800-433-8850. And all of you, just before the break, we took an email that talked about, isn't this all political? Campbell Robertson from the New York Times looked at that. I wonder what you think, Steve Camerata, too. How much is politics, especially the politics of 2012, playing into this?
Well, I think that, as I said before, the polls show that these kinds of laws are very popular, and it's clear that what's happened in the country is the public wanted this kind of response for a long time. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with immigration policy, but that it hadn't really broken through. And now it's breaking through more, that what the public has always wanted is now increasingly becoming law. And so I think that that's partly what we see here at the state level. And it's why, you know, the president will make a speech or two, but he's not introducing any serious legislation for a legalization or any of the other things that folks like Angie want, because he knows it'll hurt him in the upcoming election.
So he's dancing until 2012.
Right,
is that what
exactly.
You're saying?
He speaks to specific audiences at specific times that he knows that will listen. And then in general, he just hopes the general public mostly ignores it, because out in for most of the country, talking about amnesty and talking about this kind of administrative things where he's doing, where he's not going to be deporting whole categories of people, that's generally not popular. And for the audiences that it is, he'll talk to them about it and just hope everyone else kind of doesn't notice too much.
What about the Hispanic vote? You do hear some concern that if Republicans go too far out on this immigration limb, they're going to get hurt in the elections.
I mean, the fact is, I'm always reluctant to engage in that kind of racialized analysis of the U.S. electorate. But if you're going to do it, then you need to be honest. Hispanics will be about 8% of the vote in the coming upcoming election. Say whites will be about 80% of the vote. So if you were to gain 10 percentage points of Hispanic vote, but lose 1% of the white vote, you're worse off. But again, I don't think voters see it that way. We know that, for example, in Arizona, when they had their anti-illegal immigration proposition several years back, that almost half of all Hispanic voters actually voted for it. So again, engaging in a racialized analysis is problematic. But if you do, you have to look at the actual numbers we're talking about.
Angela, what do you think? Politics of 2012.
Sure. Look, the Latino vote is growing faster than any other demographic. The Latino vote is going to be decisive in states like Colorado, New Mexico, Florida, Nevada.
So broadly.
So it matters a whole lot going into 2012. And superb polling done of Latino voters by Latino Decisions shows that 25% of Latino voters know someone who has been deported or who is in removal proceedings. That's one out of every four Latino voters is very closely connected to this issue. They know someone who's been deported or who will be deported. This is an issue that that is the screen by which Latino voters will look at politicians through, how they're being talked about, are they being respected, or are they being dissed. So it's got enormous stakes going into the 2012. Under the Obama administration, 1 million unauthorized immigrants have been deported. He has broken records. He has exceeded, in his first term, President Bush's record of deportations in two terms. So this is a very much of a get-tough president who's going to have to try to get on the right side of his issue. What's helping him, frankly, though, are the way that the Republican candidates talk about this issue and beating up on Rick Perry for having passed an in-state tuition authorization for undocumented kids in Texas, which exists in a dozen other states. I mean, that's the immigration debate that we're having is laughable when we see what's happening on the ground in Alabama, in Georgia, in Arizona, and also other states that are trying to give undocumented students access to higher education and are going completely in the opposite direction, like Maryland, like Connecticut. So the politics are very, very dicey for both parties on this.
Well, and one more political question, and Jonathan Turley, I know you're a law professor, not a political science professor, but did the Obama administration have to sue Alabama and Arizona over these laws, or could it have let other groups take the lead in this and just say, yeah, we support this? But that's a political decision too, isn't it?
It is. There's a convergence of law and politics in this area, which really has a profile we haven't seen before. The Justice Department has historically not challenged state laws. They come in as amicus. Those amicus briefs or friends of the court briefs are taken very seriously by the courts. There's no need to be a party. They really decided that they wanted to be out in front on this. And they're also – so you have the situation where the Obama administration is actually at odds with the states at an unprecedented level, because in addition to these immigration cases, they're also in court fighting a majority of states on health care. So we actually have had now an administration that is far more in conflict. We haven't really seen these types of conflicts since the desegregation period. And so this was not legally necessary, which means it was probably more politically advisable for the perspective of some folks. But what's going to be sort of interesting is that the timing on all of these lawsuits, it seems to me, couldn't be worse, in the sense that you're very likely going to have decisions coming right before the election. And I'm not too sure what's going to be worse for the administration, to win or lose on this issue.
All right, let's take another call. And this is Eric in Prince William County, Virginia. Hi, Eric. You're on the Diane Rehm Show. Go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
In Prince William County, we did have this law written by the same lobbying firm in Washington, D.C., that wrote the Alabama and Arizona laws for 8 weeks. It was on the in March and April of 2008. It was very popular during the election season, during which, you know, in 2007 it was the main issue, until we implemented it. And then we found that some of those really convenient arguments that Steve had been making, where he ignores all of the contributions that immigrants make to the community or to the country and only looks at the costs, those things started to actually play out in real life. And we lost business owners. We lost very productive members of society who were working more than one job. We lost homeowners, and we had a foreclosure rate that was five times the regional average. We were worst on the Atlantic seaboard in foreclosures. And so after 8 weeks of implementation, a majority Republican Board of Supervisors changed their mind on the basis of the economic impact, the public safety impact. We had actually managed to reverse a 15-year trend of falling crime rates just by creating a lack of trust between law enforcement.
So it didn't work out the way that they had planned, Eric. You know, what do you think, Steve? He's raising some points that I've heard that other people raise.
Well, I think that I guess we disagree somewhat on the historical record of what happened in Prince William County. My understanding is those provisions remain popular. Most people think they were a good idea. Parts of them remain in effect. So I think we just disagree on what happened. In general, it looks like, based on the available evidence, that the illegal population in Prince William County did fall somewhat, which was the goal of the law. There were people who benefited from that. There were savings for taxpayers. And I think on balance, the county did better. And I think polling in the county that I've seen suggested most people think that the county was better off. You have to believe that allowing large numbers of unskilled immigrants remain in the country is a boon to the economy. And to do that, you have to ignore the impact on low-wage, lower-income Americans, and you have to ignore the fiscal impact. Illegal immigrants pay taxes, and they also use services. But reflecting their educational attainment, they generally make modest tax payments but use a fair amount in public services.
You know, in Campbell Robertson with the New York Times, we haven't really looked at the public safety aspects of this. What do you think about what our caller says about what happened in Prince William County?
Well, obviously, a lot of this remains to be seen.
Yeah, what have the police there been saying down in Alabama?
Well, the sheriffs have been, a lot of sheriffs have been against this, particularly given the financial status of a lot of municipalities. I mean, they're really strapped. The Jefferson County, which is where Birmingham is in particular, the department's already really hurting there extremely badly with budget cuts. And now to have to enforce this, there is a lot of pushback by police departments. I mean, obviously it varies by municipality, but I mean, even in some of these counties with high Latino populations where the sheriff already has a relationship with the feds on immigration issues, sort of a unique, some of these places, sheriffs have unique relationships because of the uniqueness of the problems. But even in those areas, there is some resistance just because of the extra burden. I mean, I think one sheriff, maybe it was in Tuscaloosa, called an unfunded mandate because it's just going to require more resources and there's no extra funding for it.
All right, let's take another call. This is Holly in Boston. And hi, Holly, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, thank you. Many of these aliens, they come to work in the United States and they send their money back home to their families rather than spending their money here in our country, in our economy, which is something that I've not heard in any discussion before. But also, just because they have a child here does not make the baby a citizen. And I just don't think that anybody is being just straight enough to address this. We're welcome to here to come and work, but that doesn't mean you have to stop having families and things, but it does not make the baby or the parent citizen.
Holly,
and
thanks.
I hope that our politicians will address this issue and make a very clear and concise message of it.
Holly, thanks for calling in. And Angela, we've gone around and around on the economics. I'm starting to think you could do a whole show just on the economics of it. But she's bringing another economic point that hasn't been highlighted, and that is she's saying, okay, they contribute economically, but they also send a lot of cash back to folks back home.
Sure. People do send money back home in the form of remittances, but they also, of course, do buy a home to live in here. They buy groceries every single week. They put clothing on the backs of themselves and their children. They make their lives here, and as I indicated, a full 60-some percent of the undocumented population has already been here for more than 10 years. So this is where their home is, and they do send some money back to support other family members. I don't know that's a bad thing. And I also do know that the children that they have here are U.S. citizens, that they are American by birth, and that is the genius of this country, is that we're not a country club. You don't have to apply to belong. And groups like the Center for Immigration Studies, where Steve works, I know want to undo that part of the Constitution, which I think would be a terrible step in a wrong direction and would take this country back to a very ugly period. Here's what I also do know, is that places like Prince William really wish that they had never passed those measures, that states like Tennessee, hardly a bastion of liberalism, looked at similar immigration measures and said, no, thank you. This is going to cost us $3 million just to pass it, $2 million every year after that. So states have made wise fiscal choices to not go down the road of Arizona, of Alabama, of Georgia, of Prince William County, because it's too expensive. And at the end of the day, Laura, it doesn't send a single unauthorized immigrant back to their country.
They may go to another state.
They just go to another state. We are kidding ourselves if we think that there's a mass exodus back to Mexico or back to Central America or back to China by passing these laws. We're just shooting ourselves in the foot economically.
Holly, thanks for that call. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Steve Camerata, I know you want to jump in there.
Well, look, on the question of citizenship, we could ask the law professor here, but we all know the answer is that the Supreme Court has never said, Congress has never ruled that the children of illegal aliens are U.S. citizens. There's never been an executive order, and there's never been a clear Supreme Court decision establishing that they're U.S. citizens. However, as a matter of custom, we have on the system sort of runs on autopilot, and we've been granting American citizenship to them. It isn't an area that I've been particularly active in, and I kind of have two minds on whether that's wise. The bottom line on the economics is you have to believe that significantly reducing the overall education profile of the United States, flooding the unskilled labor market, is good for taxpayers and good for workers at the bottom end of the U.S. labor market. All the research shows that unskilled immigrants, legal and illegal, pay nowhere near enough in taxes to cover their consumption of public services. That doesn't happen because they're lazy, and it doesn't happen because they all came for welfare. It happens because the nature of the U.S. economy doesn't offer that much to the less educated, period.
Angela.
Yeah, look, they're not eligible for benefits, and you know that.
But you know the
statistics. Undocumented folks are eligible through K-12 education, which is obviously under attack now in Alabama, and emergency medical care, and that's it. If you become a legal resident, you are barred for 5 years from having access to any federal benefits, and anybody that you sponsor has to show that they're above the poverty line, and an affidavit of support has to be filed.
So the drain argument, you don't buy
that. I don't buy it. There's no giveaways. We have made it really, really tough on people, and it hasn't worked. It's time for lawmakers to stop hiding under their desks and actually roll up their sleeves and pass a bill that would fix the problem.
Let me put some facts here. We know that more than half of illegal immigrant households access the welfare system, often on behalf of the U.S.-born children, often because of fraud, and often because states have different eligibility requirements. That's the facts.
Well, clearly we're going to have to revisit this issue again. But to close out, I want to update you on what Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano has been saying. She's delivering a speech as we speak here at American University, and she has mentioned states that continue to pass a patchwork of immigration laws. Napolitano said, "It is our position that Congress needs to take up immigration reform once and for all." I'm guessing that's an area where everybody on this panel
we're all nodding our heads.
Right, exactly. And Campbell Robertson, I wonder what you think. What is the possibility of that happening, of us getting the federal immigration solution that everyone says they're seeking?
Well, as a reporter who doesn't cover immigration, I should start by saying I have absolutely no idea. but I don't think there's any – I mean, you know, the common rhetoric on the politicians who passed this law in Alabama is that we're stepping in where the federal government has failed. So at the very least, politically, that's a popular stance in Alabama, and it is a weak point for the federal government to have states be able to say that kind of thing.
Well, and here's a Facebook comment from Michael who says, our immigration policies are a mess, but the way to deal with a bad law is to change it, not ignore it. Immigrants are an important part of America and our economy. Michael says, let's find a way to make them legal. Thanks to Arizona and Alabama for pressing the issue. What do you think, Angela? Are we going to get comprehensive immigration reform that you have been calling for?
I think at some point politicians can't avoid it. I think the demographics are destiny. And until lawmakers really feel the pressure, the way that I think they're beginning to with the patchwork of state laws, the way they're beginning to because of the interests of Latino voters who, as I said, care a lot about this issue. It will be the 800-pound gorilla in the room that they just can't ignore anymore.
Jonathan.
Well, for the first time in my life, I'm going to make an excuse for Congress, and that is it is very odd that a nation created by immigrants— we have total confusion as the status of immigrants. It is an anomaly. It's existed since the beginning of the Republic, whether it's birth citizenship or whether it's the right of states. Congress is going to have a limited ability to resolve this question until the Supreme Court resolves where the lines are drawn. And so this may be a matter where the court needs to clarify so that a political solution can be found.
All right. Well, all of you, this has been real interesting. Thank you very much for being here. I appreciate it. I'm Laura Kanoy, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thanks for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, Lisa Dunn, and Nikki Jex. The engineer is Aaron Stamper. AC Valdez answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org, and we are on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.